Kill Henry Mancini. It's Sunday night. So that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some, welcome you to 173rd episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 172 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. Once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. Miserable cold, the last thing of the week that reached its most evil hold the last Thursday, as it's seemingly morphed into bronchitis, driven pneumonia with tightness of chest, then pain. I was ready to look for the undertaker, but I began to treat it with Dick's DayQuil and NyQuil. Then luckily I had the doctor's appointment for my annual wellness exam on Friday morning and received two steroid injections to loosen my chest and a prescription of the mycin, and voila, better help through chemistry. So it was a terrific experience and it really boosted my confidence, which was already very high in medicine. My best piece for the Western Guardian, the 212th, is still available after more than 3 months. That website, www.westchesterguardian.com. The West of the Guardian is WESTCHESTERGUARDIN. It is hopefully left up there to be read by every living American, and I, of course, hope that they do. It's the last of the Creative Disruption series in the paper, as after the September 29th issue of the Westchester Guardian joined the likes of the New York Herald Tribune, the Washington Star, the New York Journal of America, and the Brooklyn Eagle in the graveyard of newspapers. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the world, articles relating to politics, sports, the environment, arts, entertainment, and technology, as well as heavy editorial opinion from all over the country. So big data, of course, to what lies ahead. But I hope you'll join us every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, to live, or as most do, to listen later from the links to recordings at the website. I hope you'll join us. Excuse me, just a cold again. Next week for my conversation with New York Times consumer technologist and USA Today Tech Now host Jennifer Jolly, then every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings. Then now to this show, the 173rd in the series, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during this show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. But I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is Bay Area journalist Janice Marrow. Janice and I got into a discussion, if not a disagreement, of concerning fake news on Facebook that led to us talking and eventually to the show. We'll speak about that later after we review her interesting life. Good evening, Janice. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
But let's get right to it. Where'd you grow up?
Well, I was born in Connecticut, but when I reached the age of 10, my father decided to maximize the possibility of melanoma for all of us and moved us to Southern Florida.
And and then you went to school there.
Yes.
How did you handle the move?
Well, I believe it was because, are you asking why we moved to Florida?
So how did you, normally children either they handle moves very well, like the Great Adventure, or the Miserable for some time because they left all their friends.
Oh, it was a great adventure. Oh, it was amazing because Connecticut, of course, you know, it snows and there's actual trees and grass that is straight. And then you go to southern Florida, it never snows. There's all these palm trees. And the grass is called St. Augustine, and it grows sort of almost like a weed in a horizontal fashion. We were fascinated when we got there.
And that when you went to grammar school there, obviously, did you aspire to be a writer when you were very young?
The grammar school I attended, which no longer exists, was Pine Ridge Elementary. And we had a wonderful teacher, Preston McMurdo was his name, and he published a newspaper called The Fourth Estate. I believe it was about 6 pages back and front, stapled, mimeographed, and stapled together. And that was my first newspaper.
Wow. And you wrote for it?
Yes, I wrote for the newspaper. I remember writing about the Cuban Missile Crisis because that was going on at the time I was in grammar school, which was pretty frightening since we were in southern Florida and expected to get blown off the map at any moment.
Write for a high school paper?
Oh, yes, I definitely wrote for the high school paper, which was Nova High School. That's in Davie, Florida, also in southern Florida.
And then off to college, what was your major?
I majored in journalism at the University of Florida. Initially, actually, I had planned to be an English major because I did love writing, and I was a poet initially. And then I talked to a career counselor about choosing my major after my first 2 years, and she told me that there were no jobs for English majors, so I should go into journalism, and which actually suits me much better, I think, than being in an ivory tower kind of environment. One of the things I love the best about journalism is being able to talk to almost anyone about almost anything, depending, of course, on your beat. But I've had a long career, so I've been able to do a lot of things that I otherwise never would have been able to do.
That's funny, because I started as a philosophy major, and then I realized that there weren't many jobs for philosopher in New York Times. So I
yes.
did something that was much more marketable, English literature. I was very lucky.
Oh, this is great.
I was very lucky to get into technology, which then eventually led me into.
But how did you get into technology?
I was in the right place at the right time. Now, the story, which it'll take a few minutes, but you're interviewing me too, so that's okay. I was the day hop. I went back and forth to college, and senior year, a friend of mine said, "Are you going to take the government test?" And I said, "No, I don't want to work for the government. I'm going to go to law school at night and do this." He said, "Well, you ought to take the test anyhow. There's something to fall back on. And besides, you can drive me up." It was on the Saturday up at Iona College. So I committed to it. And the night before, I stayed out until 4 o'clock in the morning. one of our local talking to a young have blown the whole thing off, but I promised him. So I drove him up, and we took the test. I obviously did well, and I had the boring job at the life insurance company. They were paying for a good deal to my law school. So I was, and I would get all these things in the mail to be a border guard or an IRS auditor and all of these things. And finally, our law school lost its bloom when I found real property and personal property costs is very boring, and the equitable also boring. And I got this telegram from the Department of the Army that they were starting a pilot program for the Department of Defense in a management training program, and they interviewed me, and they had gone through 20,000, 2 million resumes, and they were going to interview 200 people for 4 years.
Whoa.
And that sounded interesting. So I went off to the Brooklyn Army Journal that was at the other end of New York where I lived. And I wound up being one of the four. I got to walk around and work in different departments for 6 months. Everything from the administrative areas to people that were setting up how the Army ships were loaded to go wherever. And when I asked him where I wanted to work, I said, data processing, because the most intelligent people that I met there worked there. It wasn't because I even knew anything about computers, didn't have any interest in them. And that led to a lifetime career. I wound up managing a big computer operation for two Wall Street firms, have my own consulting business that got me into writing and to teaching. So I was just very lucky. I was in the right place at the right time twice in my life. That was the first one. And the second one, when my wife and I were leaving Morgan Stanley to start our own business, I happened to be by the elevator. And a fellow came along and he said, "I understand you're leaving." I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I wish you well in all this." And he said, have you seen the computer on Ben Rosen's desk?" And I said, "No, who's Ben Rosen?" So, and how did you put a computer on a desk? So we went off to see Ben Rosen, and he had an Apple II, which I'd never seen before. And it didn't do anything but play games and run some portfolio programs, some own packages on cassette tape. And I said, "Yeah, that's very interesting. I would have one of them just to fool around with." And about 3 months later, the first spreadsheet came along. And that changed our lives, because we had planned to do large computer financial consulting, and we wound up doing training all over the country in using spreadsheets and selling computers. And writing about them, they asked the magazine called Popular Computing asked Dan Brooklyn, who had developed the first spreadsheet program, VisiCalc, Bob Frankson, to write an article about how people use these tools. So he said, "No, we don't do that, but you should talk to Barbara McMullen, who knows more about this than anyone." So they talked to my wife, and she wrote the article, and I edited it. And from then on, we both wrote, and eventually I became the full-time writer, and she became the full-time editor. So it was all just being someplace. I've been very, very lucky. So that's my story.
That's amazing.
Now, let's talk to the U.S. Then after college, you stayed on for a master's. How come, and then what?
Well, actually, what happened after college was I was sitting in a cafe, and the loudspeaker was playing Savoy Brown doing Wang Dang Doodle by Willie Dixon, and I had an epiphany. I realized that I could be anywhere I wanted in the United States, if not the world, because I had graduated from college, so I wasn't going to school anymore. And the job I had was just, you know, kind of marking time type job, wasn't anything special. I wasn't in a relationship. And the first place I thought of was New York. But then the second place, I thought, "Oh, yeah, well, New York, I'm a journalist." And then I thought, California. It was like, I had never been to California. I had never been west of Texas. I knew nothing. All I knew about California was, you know, everything I'd seen, all the articles I'd read about it, and all the various appearances of California in all kinds of different movies and TV shows. And it was like, yeah, California. So So, and again, it's kind of interesting along the lines of what you were just talking about. Just coincidentally, a friend of a friend happened to be driving to California. So I got a ride, and I did have some friends in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, and he was on his way to UC Davis to get his master's, so he dropped me off in Berkeley, and for most of the time since then, I've been here, having never been here before I first came here, but the minute I arrived, I was like, oh, I'm home. This is amazing.
And then how'd you start working there? Who were you working for?
Well, there is a, you may have heard of Bay City News Service. It's one of the only places, or at least at the time, it was one of the only places in the Bay Area where you could get a job as a journalist with no experience. And of course, I did have a journalism degree. So I approached the folks at Bay City News Service, and I was able to get a job. And it's kind of like a mom and pop version of AP or UPI. It's still around. And that way I got to cover some of the most amazing stories because they are in San Francisco. And I imagine they probably still pay minimum wage just like they did then.
Then how long were you there?
I was there for a few years. And I started freelancing for various newspapers in the Bay Area. And that's the way I kind of worked my way in. And then I had actually another epiphany. I learned about The Well, where you and I met. And in 1995, I became a member of The Well, and it was February 14th, beginning my lifelong romance with the internet. That's how I always used to look at it. And
so just faded out on me for a moment, and then it came back.
Okay, so what I was saying is I joined The Well, and I joined The Well on February 14th, 1995, and Valentine's Day, and I've always thought of it as the start of a lifelong romance with all things digital. And once I joined The Well, I became interested in online journalism, and that's when I went back to graduate school. I decided I wanted to, it was somewhat naive. I thought, oh, I want to learn to write HTML, and I want to learn to be an online journalist. So I'm going to leave the San Francisco Bay Area, which of course is ground zero for all things digital in Silicon Valley, and I'm going to go back to the University of Florida because they offered me a really great deal, tuition waiver and teaching assistantship and so forth. And so I either sold or, well, I really didn't sell anything. I gave away almost everything I owned, and I moved back to Florida. And then as soon as I got there, I realized it only takes about 15 minutes to learn HTML. And I really, the whole thing probably was unnecessary. But I had a wonderful time. I loved graduate school. And that is where I learned how to build websites and where I got my start in digital journalism.
For the audience, The Well that Janet is referring to was the Whole Earth Chronic Link. It was founded by the Stuart Brand, who was one of the developers of the Whole Earth News, and Larry Brilliant, who was the book out at the present time. And it was the place pre-web that many groups came together to talk about either technology issues such as privacy and what we called hacking then. And then also there was the Big Bay Area influence. There was a very heavy Grateful Dead presence, and there was also a psychology basis. So we all came together. I was an early member of The Well, and I was there for its genesis, what was known as a hackers conference, and then the group came together to found the Computer Freedom and Privacy Conference that's now in about its 40th year, I guess. And it was very interesting. Who was the executive director when you worked there?
Gail Williams.
Oh, okay. That was after John Coates, who was known as Tex, was the executive director when I first became involved, followed by to Gallo. I knew the whole lot of the wonderful people there, the late Tom Mandel, who was written about by Katie Hafner in her book on the Well, Jim Warren, who was the guiding spirit in CFP1, Bruce Cole, as my editor when I wrote for publication Microtimes after I got to know her the Well.
Oh, Microtimes. Yeah, Mary Eisenhart. She's a dear person. Yes.
The wonderful Jennings, Peter and Dorothy, and many others. So you left the Well then, and then you went to Florida. Then how did you get back to California?
Well, actually, one of my main bulwarks the whole time I was in Florida in graduate school was the Well. I probably spent 2 hours a day posting on the Well because I did miss California. I enjoyed graduate school enormously, but what happened is, so while I was in graduate school, which was from 1996 to 1998, that was right when the internet was just starting to really get big. And what happened was that was also when Craigslist first appeared on the scene. So I was in Gainesville, Florida, and I was getting my degree. It was like a master's in communication specializing in the internet. I wrote my thesis on why people read online newspapers, which of course in 1996 through 98 was a valid question. And what happened was after I finished my thesis, I was looking online and I saw Craigslist and I saw that there were all these jobs in digital journalism and in journalism in the Bay Area advertised on Craigslist. So I had intended to stay in Florida, but it just seemed like that was when it dawned on me that this is where it's all happening, is the West Coast, is specifically California and Silicon Valley. So that's why I came back. Driving across the United States in a 20-year-old Volvo, I'll never forget it.
And who'd you begin working for out there? How'd you hook up?
The Well. As a matter of fact, the first job I got was with The Well. I became the marketing director.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, and then how long were you there?
I was there a couple of years, and then I went to the Contra Costa Times and became an online editor, which was the, you know, pretty much the job that I had in mind for quite some time. And then Knight Ridder bought the Contra Costa Times, and I would have been moved to San Jose. Those folks who don't live in the Bay Area, I was living in the East Bay, and it would have been an arduous commute. So at that point, I went to Adweek's San Francisco Bureau and started covering online advertising, which at that time had just been born, basically. At that point, I believe it was 2000, and that was right when the dot-com boom was really at its zenith. So I got to participate in that whole scene the way that the journalists got treated at that time by dot-coms. I mean, believe it or not, this is really true. They actually would do things like send limos to your office to take you to one of their dot-com parties. It was quite a time.
Yeah, it was. It was the whole emergence, and we had people who were out in the Bay Area. Markoff, who built the name there in high tech and wound up with the New York Times, and it was very interesting then. After Adweek, you began work as what you refer to as the freelance public relations practitioner. Work you continue while engaging in various other reporting and public information jobs. What exactly is a freelance public relations practitioner?
Well, it's kind of funny because one of the first jobs I got was for a company called Ecotality. I think that was the name of the company, and they don't exist anymore. And it was very interesting because, again, this was just when I would say the whole idea of online marketing and advertising was still relatively nascent. Or is that how you say that word? Nascent?
Yes.
a borning. It was just starting, in other words. And one of the things I would do is I was covering, I had covered energy anyway. So I was familiar with a lot of websites devoted to the subject of energy. And this company was working on an alternative type of engine that would use natural gas. So I would visit all these websites, and actually all I did was just post on the websites at will, you know, at websites and on blogs, just the way I normally would about energy, but the track back was my Ecotality email address. And so it was a really subtle form of marketing. That was one of the things I did. Also, there was at the time, and then later on, Redfin, for example, the real estate disintermediation site, had blogs in the Bay Area. And so I was a blogger for Redfin, writing about just things like, you know, real estate sales and prices, stuff like that. So those kinds of things.
You may remember how advertising came when Wired first started accepting advertising. They were being paid thousands of dollars a month just for having an ad on a page. And then one of the pharmaceutical companies said, we're not going to do this anymore. We're only going to pay for click-throughs, where you come from your page to our page. And when Time Magazine bought that, all the other people had been resisting. Then all of a sudden, the whole ball game changed, and you weren't making money just by showing up and posting an ad. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. It was so fascinating to watch the way the whole thing evolved. Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, and of course, it's always dangerous to say something is first, but among the first, at least, definitely was Wired to run ads on its site. And at first, I bet there's probably some of us who were sort of a bit, at least to some extent, pioneers who remember this, but a lot of people, this would come as a surprise, I bet, that people actually used to read online ads. They actually, because it was an anomaly, it was a novelty, and so they would click on them because they were interesting and different. I remember that phase. I went through that phase when I actually did that. And, of course, now I think people generally respond to online advertising much more similarly to the way they've been responding to ads in magazines for a long time, which is, you know, not necessarily paying that much attention to them.
Rather ignoring them as they go by. Then we got into, of course, the intelligent ads that Google brought us, where they examined your profile and they tried to be relevant. And I don't know if that's the end of it or if there'll be other breakthroughs in online advertising. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, I think, and that's a really good point because again, a lot of people don't even know that Google at one time did not exist. I remember going to a party in the Bay Area and somebody handing me their card and it said, and the Google logo was on their card. That was the first time I ever saw it. And yeah, Google to me is really simply the online equivalent of the Yellow Pages. It's a genius marketing approach. The idea is when people used to look, you know, oh my goodness, a pipe burst in my basement, I need a plumber. They used to pick up a thick book the pages actually were yellow, and they would look through the pages for plumbers. I need a plumber. This is where I'll find a plumber. And so, of course, those books ran huge ads for all kinds of different businesses because it was targeted advertising in its prehistoric form. And then, Google, of course, refined that quite a bit, as you say, to target people's interests, things they really needed and really wanted, and that transformed the whole thing. And as far as, well, I don't know if there's going to be anything new. It's been a while since there's been any real, that I can see any real particular innovations in online advertising. To me, do you think so?
There was also an example of the way things change. then offered to everyone. There was a big privacy. People jumping up and down saying, "Wait, they're going to analyze your mail and they're going to know to what you want for advertising." And people went back and forth about how terrible. And most people just ignored it without realizing even that they weren't really analyzing your writing. They're analyzing people writing to you. And then after a while, people just forgot about that. It's just like when Carla, I this is an awful thing because whistleblowers aren't going to use it. And you'll know my reaction to that was, if you live in an apartment and someone rings your doorbell, there's a little people you can look at and see if you want to open the door. And after a while, people just accepted that too. So very often technology brings us these big intellectual hullabos. Then after a while, people just forget about it and they just carry on. Do you remember those arguments?
That is absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And to me, the analogy is, when I was at Adweek, I went to Seattle and I wrote a story about the Experience Music Project, which I don't know if you've ever, it's a building in Seattle, and it's a very, very innovative building. And when I got there to write the story, there was an enormous hullabaloo, as you said, about that building. People were outraged. They thought it was, you know, just really hideous. They really thought that it would ruin downtown Seattle because it was in downtown. And Frank Gehry was the individual who designed it. He's known for his wild designs. He designed an opera house in Australia, I believe, that's also very, very striking. And there, people said things about the Experience Music Project, like it looks like the Partridge Family bus crashed and nobody picked up the pieces. And of course now nobody gives it a second look. Everyone accepts it. Why? Because it's been there forever. And you know, they've been passing it. Now it's sort of like they've been passing it every day, or you know, when they first came to Seattle, it was there already. So they didn't even give it a second thought. And as you said, exactly, that a lot of times new technology sets off controversy, and then all, as time goes by, people just accept it. DoubleClick, as I recall, was the name of the company that got, oh man, they got dragged over the coals. This would have been, I think, in around the year 2000, because they were aggregating data and matching it. And of course, you know, their defense, which in retrospect we realize was a valid defense, was it was aggregation. It was not individuals, but rather they were analyzing the metrics of how many people would visit a given website and what time would they go and what did they buy and that kind of thing, which of course nowadays people think is harmless and accept without question.
And we have the people who put data together on individuals that most people don't even know about, and they don't worry about it. And in some cases,
exactly.
that's unfortunate. You're also a reporter for the Oakland Tribune. Tell us about that work.
Well, here in the San Francisco Bay Area, almost every newspaper is owned by a company called Bay Area News Group, which has news. Well, actually, the parent company is Media News, and they own newspapers all over the country. The chain used to be owned by an individual named Dean Singleton, who was well known in the newspaper industry. The flagship was in Colorado. And so I have worked, because there's the San Francisco Chronicle, which is not owned by this company, but every other newspaper practically in the Bay Area is owned by Media News Group. And here in the Bay Area, it's known as Bay Area News Group. And so I have worked for the Hayward Daily Review, the Oakland Tribune, the Contra Costa Times, the San Mateo County Times, and right now, actually, I am at the Marin Independent Journal. And all those papers are part of that group. So, and recently, actually, a number of them were rolled into one paper, which is known as the East Bay Times. So I work in Marin County, known nationally for its hot tubs, at a daily newspaper.
So the Marin Independent News really isn't independent because it's part of a conglomerate.
Now that you mention it, it's definitely part of this national chain of newspapers. I hadn't thought of that. I would imagine, I don't really know for sure, but I would imagine that sometime in the past, probably, I would think that there was probably a paper called the Marin Independent and a paper called the Marin Journal, and maybe they merged, but I don't really know that for sure.
Right. You're also the public information officer for a transportation authority. Tell us about that work.
I did work for California High Speed Rail for a while, that because it was a natural transition, because I had been covering transportation for the Contra Costa Times. And so I started working in Sacramento, the capital of California, as a public information officer for California High Speed Rail. And it was a challenging job because at that time the plan was to start building high speed rail, because the system does not exist now. It's under construction. And at that time the plan was to start building high speed rail in the Central Valley of California. And actually there was some resistance among the people who lived in that area. And since then, the plan has changed, and now it's pretty much getting started here in the Bay Area, where people are very receptive to public transit.
How does that relate to BART then?
Oh, BART, I guess you would call BART is pretty much the subway here in the Bay Area. So it's a commuter train that runs, I think, all the way from far, far east in the East Bay. I think Pittsburgh conquered that area in the East Bay, for those folks from this area who are listening, all the way. Then it goes all the way to Oakland, to Berkeley, to San Francisco, and then continues on south of San Francisco. I think there are stops in Daly City. I'm not naming everything. And then it also runs in the west Contra Costa County area and further south and further in the east in the East Bay. So that's BART. BART is the commuter train, and high speed rail is envisioned as a train that would run from, I think the idea at present, there's been some shifts in the plans, but I think the idea is to run from San Francisco to LA. So the focus of high-speed rail is a longer distance.
Okay. It's almost like the local things on the East Coast, the Amtrak, which obviously is not high-speed, but it brings everything together of a long distance.
Yeah, that's right.
While you were at the authority, you also took on the duties of a commuted advice class for Cleancode.com, work that continues to this day. What's that all about? That sounds interesting.
Yeah, what happened is, actually, I had been covering energy for, as I say, Bay Area News Group. And since I was writing about energy, I wrote a story about Ride Your Bike to Work Day. And then I started writing a little bit about commuting, and the next thing I knew, I was the executive editor at the time, Kevin Keene, decided to move me to Metro, where I became a transportation reporter, and I started writing a twice-weekly advice column, which I was thrilled to do. And it was a lot of fun. Then after I left, and the column was very popular, I'm not taking credit for it, it had been around for a long time. So I walked right into a really great position and wrote about, wrote this advice column for a couple years. When I left the paper, I was approached by a popular award-winning blog in the area called claycord.com, which is a combination of Clayton and Concord, which are two central Contra Costa County blogs here in the San Francisco Bay Area. They're kind, I guess you would say they're north of Berkeley. And so I was approached by the editor, and he asked if I wanted to continue to write a transportation column. So I was excited to do that. And it is, it's a lot of fun.
It would sound like you're the Dear Abby of commuting.
Yeah, exactly. And there's just as much agony in commuting these days, I think, for most people as there is in relationships.
To bring us up to the present, you have for almost the last 5 years, as I mentioned, been with the Marin Independent Journal, and you mentioned you're an education reporter. During that time, you've also won an award from the California Newspaper Publishing Association. Please tell us about the paper, your reporting, and what led to the award.
Yes, well, education is a tremendously interesting beat, especially right now. I'm sure you're way ahead of me on this, and most of the listeners, no doubt as well, that there is a I think probably it's not too extreme to call it a battle going on across the country between charter schools and public schools. There are advocates, very strong advocates for charter schools, and then there are people who feel that charter schools funnel money and teachers and so forth away from established public schools, and there's definitely some disagreement there. There are a lot of people who are very strong advocates in favor of charter schools, many of them in Silicon Valley, because Silicon Valley is all about disruption. So that's one of the things that I've been covering. And of course, the nominee for Secretary of Education is a primary, very, very major advocate of charter schools. And so the story I wrote was about something that really struck me when I first started covering education, which is that completely apart from and has nothing to do with charter schools, but the typical tenure, the average tenure, length of tenure for a school district superintendent is 3 years. And that seemed like a very short amount of time to me for someone in such a leadership role. And so I was struck by that, and I decided to write a story about it. And that was the story that won the award for education reporting. And after I finished my story, I felt the question was no longer why is it so short, but how does anyone last for any length of time at all? Because one of the things I learned is that superintendents have so many bosses. They have the school board to answer to. They have all the administrators in the schools, the public to answer to. They sometimes administer school districts that are the size of a small town, so it's almost like they're the mayor of a city. And sometimes the people, all the various people they have to answer to, don't agree with each other about what they want. So it can be pretty demanding. So it was very interesting to find that out.
One of the interesting things about charter schools that I didn't realize until a conversation that we had about 3 weeks ago on the show was someone from Detroit talking about this woman who's moving into the education department. And then they were saying how the charter schools, they're able to pick their students and they're able to take the best students and they're able to do this. And I said, gee, I didn't understand that, because I was on the board of a group that was trying to start a charter school in New York City of a science and technology, and they had to have the lottery within the school district. All the students had to come from within the school district, and they had to have a lottery, and they also had to have accommodations for alternative learning and everything. Then someone else said, well, that's because that's New York State, that there are different requirements in every state. And some of the awful things that you hear about charter schools may only be in Oklahoma, not in California or on and on. And the funding is even different from state to state. Do you come down with any big feelings on charter schools yourself?
Well, one thing, I think it's really, that's a very, very good point that you made, because I believe the way it works is that in California, and it sounds like you just explained to me, so, and I appreciate, thank you for sharing that, because I didn't know. So in other words, you're saying that this varies from state to state, because in California, I think it is the, if I'm not mistaken, it is the chartering entity that determines where the students must come from. So if a given district is the chartering, grants the charter, then the students have to come from within that district. In the case of a charter school that was recently chartered in Marin County, it was the charter came from the state of California. And I'm pretty sure that school does not have to draw. I'm almost positive the students can come from outside the district. And one of the things about California that I've heard many people say about the charters is that these people feel that charters are not accountable because the school boards are not elected. And I know, again, that some school boards with which I'm familiar, some school boards for charter schools with which I'm familiar have members who are not, you know, who don't live in the district and don't live in the state. So those are some of the criticisms that I've heard. And then at the same time, like I said, now you're explaining that you wanted to start a science and technology charter, and again, Silicon Valley obviously is a just seems like an ideal location for such a charter. So I would think that would probably be a place it would flourish.
The way you understand it, can they screen the applicants and only take the cream of the crop? Or is it similar to New York where they have to have a lottery of all the people who want to come there? So to get a mix.
I believe that issue did surface when there was a certain charter that I was covering was trying to get chartered, and I believe it's more a case of pick and choose in California. That's the impression I got, but that is just from one particular school. But that's my sense of it.
That's one of the criticisms that people have about schools. I went to I'm the product of Catholic education, and the high school that I went to for the last 10 years, 100% of the graduates have been accepted by Catholic schools, or any private school has the right to expel people for either not performance or for their behavior, whereas the public schools can. So the whole idea of taking money from the public schools and comparing it to the private schools is the difficult idea for me. I tend to be against vouchering and school choice. What's your opinion on that?
Well, so one thing that does happen, although it doesn't happen in every instance, there are different ways. School districts in California are not all funded via the same formula, but in many instances, there is funding that depends on how many students there are in a school, and it's way more complicated than that. But the funding does. I think it has to do with average daily attendance, and it gets very Byzantine very quickly. But the idea is that the funding does depend on how many pupils there are in the school, and the money follows the pupil. So what happens is you have these schools in California that they already exist. They have playing fields. They have music departments with pianos and instruments. They have an infrastructure, in other words, set up. They have an auditorium. They have a library. They have all these facilities. And what happens is the charter comes along, and the charter is now going to have to duplicate much of that for itself. It can request under a legislation called Prop 39 here in California, the charter can request space on the school's grounds, but that doesn't mean the students are going to use all the facilities I just mentioned. So then that charter either has to build them or create them or somehow provide them itself, and it's kind of duplicative. And meanwhile, the public school has just lost all that funding. But the public school still has to pay its gas bill, and it still has to pay its water bill, and obviously some of the public school can lay off teachers. But probably would do so because of losing students. But you can see how that isn't a great thing for the public school.
Sure. We're even having education. There was just a decision to close a nuclear plant on Hudson River, fairly close to me, called the Indian Point plant, by 2020, and all of the funding by the town of Buchanan, where it is, come from the taxes that are paid by this, and
whoa,
and much of the Westchester County gets a whole lot of money. So to their question is, well, you're right on public policy, but what do we do now? You know, one of those deals, you know. So it's these all become very complex issues.
Yeah, seriously.
Now to our sub, and I'll lead into it. By the way, I wrote a December 27 piece about this on Medium, which I will link to when I write about tonight's show. I really felt snookered by the bit of fake news that I posted in a Christmas Day Facebook posting, a piece that showed a picture of hundreds of thousands of Muslims gathered together with the headline of 20 million Muslims protesting the extremist actions of ISIS, and if the Western media was ignoring this action. Actually, the gathering was the religious Hajj pilgrimage, but I bit and posted it as written. It was particularly galling when I found out it was fake, because I had written the column that previous September 15th for the aforementioned Voice of the Guardian, pointing out that you can't trust information just because you find it on the internet. Someone had jumped up and down on Facebook because he had come across two headlines on the Wall Street Journal of the day after Trump went to Mexico and spoke to his gathering that night when he came home. They both had the same picture of Trump, and on one of the columns it says Trump modifies his position meeting with Mexico, and the other will build the wall and we'll do whatever. And the person used it as an example that the Wall Street Journal was pandering to people in different places and trying to sell. But actually, the first headline was from their early editions after he came back from Mexico, and it was before his meeting with his followers. The second edition was the late one, the second headline. And if anyone knew anything about newspapers, they could have seen that what was on top, because they had the masthead up on top, and that there were two different editions. But it went on and on, and I referred them to Snoop, who had already looked at this. So I was really upset. Thankfully, one of the people commenting on my posting, not the first person by any means, but Isabel Rose points out that the story was a phony and documented it by turning people on to Snoops, where I had referred to earlier in my other column. It was later for me when Janice berated me for being irresponsible for not removing the posting. And then the discussion began. Janice, is that a fair statement?
Yes.
And describe at least your initial reaction to the incident.
Well, I was just surprised because, you know, I have enormous respect for you as a journalist and someone who is tremendously accurate, and I think I remember that whole kerfluffle about mischaracterizing what happened in terms of those New York Times headlines, and so it was sort of like et tu, you know, not you too, you know, that was how I felt. It was like, oh no, and so that was, I pointed it out, and then I guess I sort of expected you to immediately respond and say, oh, that's true, this is wrong. And so when I think about a day went by or something, and that was when I sort of felt, I was upset about it, concerned about it.
Did I was irresponsible? I responded after thinking about it that I didn't know the end. That if something's published in Marine Independent or in the New York Times and it turns out to be wrong, they publish every traction or correction 2 days later or a week later, but there's no way for them to go back and to unprint what they are already printed. So I was, my understanding was, yes, there was an error. It was pointed out, but there isn't anything that I should really do about it now, because if I deleted it, I would have deleted the whole flap about it. There's something wrong. It should have been checked out, and they were right now, and we would have deleted all of the responses. So what we wound up doing when we talked about it was we asked what the other people thought. They also wrote the piece on the 727, and I asked for comments. And since then, we've been underwhelmed by the responses, as though nobody cares by now. So what's your feeling on it?
I guess to me, when I got caught the first time, what I did was I apologized to the person who pointed it out, and I did take the post down, because to me, keeping the post up continues to promote the misinformation. And somebody who's scrolling along, maybe they see your post and they see the photo and the headline, and that headline is misleading and it's not true. Maybe they don't stop to go through the comment thread and learn that, in fact, in the comment thread, it was pointed out that the post is misleading, that the headline is misleading. So that was what I was thinking.
Now, when you deleted your original post, did all comments go away too? Then, in other words,
yes, they did.
So, in other words, the discussion never happened then.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, and your point is excellent. That it's in a way, maybe it's better not to delete the post, because if you leave it up, then you are leaving up something. It's like a retraction, right? The post, if people do read the comment thread, then they see, oh, this isn't true.
Is that what
you're thinking?
Maybe what I should have done was to actually go in and to edit my original post and say, by the way, this is not true. So when they saw it, they would have said right up front that don't believe this. It was my error. That I could have done, and quite frankly, I never thought of it. And you're absolutely right in one way, because months after I went on the tirade about that Wall Street Journal thing, and I posted it and I wrote an article about it, and on Facebook I said no. The same thing showed up months later. This is an example of how the Wall Street Journal does this, and it was just as wrong the second time around as it was the first time. It was the exact same thing. So maybe the best way it would have been to leave it up, but to edit the original one in some way saying, this is my era, don't believe it.
Yeah, I'm good with that. Of course, you don't really have to say it's your error. It's the error of the fake news site. But you could say, you know, this is a fake news site. This is fake news. This isn't true. I found out about it after I posted it, and I want everyone to know that this isn't true. I think that's I'm good with that.
But after telling people that they shouldn't bite anything suspicious and they should go to Snoop's, you know, so I in some way I should have said miracle. This leads us into really the whole discussion though, because if we found out as a result of the hullabaloo about what the Russians did, there are actually not only fake news sites in the former Soviet Union trying to influence us. There are fake sites that I've heard interviewed on NPR who are making money out of this. They're disseminating stories and they're getting paid for it, and they're untrue about everything. How do we mandate or how do we ensure integrity in this digital world, which is your world?
Yeah, you know, and I know you're way ahead of me on this, and I'm sure many, many listeners as well. The newspaper business is not doing that well, and those of us who remain in the newspaper business are working our hearts out, making sure everything we do or doing everything humanly possible to make sure our stories are accurate, interviewing sources, looking things up, you know, going to the original source and spending a lot of time and agony doing that. And meanwhile, the individual you mentioned is Justin Kohler, and he told NPR he makes $10,000 to $30,000 a month with his fake sites. So not only is he corrupting the whole process and misleading everyone who reads those stories, he's taking it to the bank. And I very strongly encourage folks. And another thing he does, it's very, very sneaky because he has created, for example, one of his sites is abcnews.com.co. So, you know, if you're just scrolling along on Facebook and you see the headline, and of course the stories are written in news fashion, they're credible, you know, when you first read the headline. And then you look at the source, abcnews.com.co. And so obviously the URL, the web address for ABC News is abcnews.com. His site added a .co at the end. And he has I don't think this one is his, but then there's one called bloomberg.ma. And Bloomberg is, of course, a very highly credible site,
Bloomberg
credible
dot
source,
what?
Just like
what was that?
Bloomberg.ma. So instead of bloomberg.com, it's bloomberg.ma.
I would think that both ABC and Bloomberg would have legal recourse to this, wouldn't you?
That is an interesting question. You know, that hadn't occurred to me, but you would think so because their credibility, obviously their gravitas is being, and their name is being used, except that they just give it a different extension. There's an MSNBC.com.co, there's USAtoday.com.co, WashingtonPost.com.co, and most of those are Justin Kohler, the individual you mentioned who was interviewed on NPR and said that he makes $10,000 to $30,000 a month.
What was the reaction?
I
haven't heard any follow-up.
I don't know. I'm actually, as we speak, I'm scrolling through the interview right now. His company is called Disinfomedia.
Disinfomedia?
One thing is, when you ask for the reaction, but I know that Facebook is under a lot of pressure because it appears that to a great extent, Facebook is one of the major outlets for this kind of thing. And I believe that they are working on formulating some policies that would change how that happens.
The problem there is, though, that you could get some independent that they never heard of, some either alt-right very left-wing group that they could say, because the outrageous things that these groups are saying, that they're not real, and dismiss them, and you'd be losing your you saying being caught, really. You know, you wouldn't be able to get out your political views. So it's a tough line to walk, you know, to decide who is real and who's making things up.
Well, do you mean, in other words, if it's a source you've never heard of, that doesn't necessarily mean that the source is dishonest.
Yeah. They may be extreme on either end, and they may be writing editorials to prove that Obama is a Muslim, or that is an agent of the Soviet Union. They may really believe it, though, and they just mean their editorial opinion, and so they're not really putting out fake information that they're getting paid for.
Oh yeah, well I mean obviously I hope I'm not misunderstanding what you're saying, but I'm just thinking, for example, The Onion, we all know, is,
right,
is deliberately saying things that aren't true, but they're doing it to amuse, not to mislead,
Andy Borowitz in The New Yorker is always making.
Oh God, I love that. Yeah, I love Andy Borowitz, exactly. And the thing is, I mean, I love both of them, and I read, you know, they post on Facebook, I'll read their pieces, and then I read the comments, and always in the comments there's, you know, quite a few people who think it's true and are angry, you know, oh no, I can't believe that someone is going to blow up the entire state of Texas, you know, or whatever ridiculous thing has been suggested.
Yeah, it brings us to real journalism. We talked about there being not a market for philosophers or for English majors, but we promoted journalism, and my students who are the journalism majors, they almost feel like asking why. And I point out, for instance, that we have algorithms writing sports stories based on the statistics that are brought in from basketball games or from football games, you know, and they're able to.
John, you're kind of fading out on me. Hi, John. So, John, I've lost the signal. You still there? Hi, can you hear me? I think you may be back. No, I still can't hear you.
and I was singing along. Oh, here she is. That
Hi,
wasn't
John.
You. That wasn't you. There was a crash here that I'll be able to edit out later, but it was everything just went down the hatch. Can you hear me okay now?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you great.
Okay. On the my question that I had asked was the future of journalism when we have algorithms writing stories and we have fake news and we have all this, and it's a contracting newspaper market, and people are trying to make money from sites like Medium and others. Where do you see your industry going?
Well, one, it is a pretty bleak outlook, I must say, especially because I have been working for newspapers for a long time, and I've kind of watched the slide, which is not exactly inspiring. I will say I do think that this phenomenon of fake news will be quashed. It reminds me, in a way, a little bit of spam. Remember, spam was a terrible problem for many years. One of the biggest problems in terms of using, you know, the internet or going online, just getting flooded with spam and entreaties from Nigerian princes and the like, and we managed to lick that. I do think I have confidence that fake news will get wrestled to the ground, and I understand, you know, as we were discussing, that Facebook is looking into ways to make it easier to report fake news, and also they might do some partnerships with outside fact-checking organizations to help indicate when articles are false. I'm hoping, you know, that Snopes.com might be one of them, because you had mentioned Snopes earlier, and they're one of the most wonderful sites. They're decades old now, by now, I think at least 10 years old, and they've been checking. They started out fact-checking urban myths, and now they're, I would say, the go-to site for checking the veracity of news online. And actually, a friend of mine just started working there. Yeah, but as far as the industry in general, what I would say, one, there is a very positive in development, which I'm sure you already know about, which is the New York Times subscriptions soared after the election, and I believe this is the case for some other major media as well.
But in many areas, people aren't familiar with how to actually make money from some of these areas, because people don't want to pay for content.
Yes, that's right. And you know, I have to tell you again, I was an early adopter, writing my thesis, doing my graduate work on why people read online newspapers back in 1998 was when the thesis was published. And I remember that when I started working as an online editor at the Contra Costa Times, my friends were all telling me, we try to read the classified ads on your paper and we can't find them. They're utterly disorganized. They're not, you know, they're not all in the same place for the same city. You know, they're full of weird line breaks. This is impossible. And I told the editors of the website, and that was as far as it went. I worked briefly as a contract employee at the LA Times while I was in graduate school, and at a meeting of the editor at that time, a new editor had just started at the website, and I said, why must we repurpose? What if we just made the website separate from the paper? And again, there was no one, it wasn't even considered, and you know, to me, it's like newspapers kind of allowed all that revenue to to, you know, to fly away had action been taken earlier and people been forced to pay for subscriptions online, we wouldn't be in the position we're in now. And it's too bad. And of course, people expect it to be free because that's how they first encountered it, unfortunately. So yeah, it's definitely a problem. And it doesn't look like the advertising model is going to save the day. John? Hello?
No, she fell. We had it again. Damn, she dropped. Barbara? I had it for a while. Now she dropped. You drop. Damn. I hope she comes back in. Now you drop.
Hi, can you hear me? Oh,
yeah,
I'm so sorry.
I'm
I was in the same place. I wonder if I should go outside. Let me try. I'm going to go into a different room. Can you still hear me? Hello? Hi, John.
Okay. She's going to come back in and she's going to be here. Oh, this is a mess. Damn. Oh, I could hear you, and you weren't hearing me. I don't know if it was an ongoing thing because of the wiring problem that we had here, or whether it's there was at your end. This hasn't happened before here. We did have a complete power out once, but I don't know. It's the weather, or what it is. I will try to wrap it up and maybe we can dub something in by recording or whatever.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine. I'm like sitting in the exact same position and not moving an inch.
but I'm on my telephone now. I'm on my landline. I'm connected online, but I'm calling you on the regular telephone. And unfortunately, it's a pound going out over the air, which I'm just picking up. So I'm gonna have to do heavy editing. I will sign off online, and I'll call you back.
Okay. All right. Bye.
All right. So we gotta get rid of all that at the end. Let's clear. Okay. What